Welcome to Let's Talk Memoir, a podcast for memoir lovers, readers, and writers. I'm your host, Ronit Plank. Dear Let's Talk Memoir listeners, it's Ronit, and I want to thank you for an incredible season 3. I can't believe we have already hit the last of the episodes, which I think amount to about 40, and we kicked off season 3 with Abigail Thomas. The great news is while I normally take a hiatus between seasons, I have heard the response, I have gotten some feedback that the break is not fun for my listeners. So the big news for me is that next week, season 4 begins immediately. So I'm just going to roll right into season 4. I've already got a whole bunch of episodes lined up and ready to go. So you wouldn't even realize we were going into season 4, except that, of course, I just told you. So I wanted to thank you for your support and for your reviews and for sharing the show and for the lovely messages I get. Thank you so much for helping me make Let's Talk Memoir as fun as you do and as rewarding. And thank you to my incredible guests for sharing generously of your time and expertise. Obviously, I wouldn't even have a show if I didn't have memoirists and teachers who were so kind and illuminating. I'm so happy to bring you this final episode of season 3, Having Roots and Losing Them, writing about the crisis in Venezuela through memoir featuring Paula Raimon, who joins me to talk about pivoting from journalism to memoir to tell the story of the collapse in Venezuela and to understand the history of her country before and after Chavez through her mother's life, this feeling of guilt that seems to informs so much of her family's story and her own relationship to her country and her family, and the physical and emotional losses she has faced, and also the toll of migration on the body, and her memoir, Motherland. I am so grateful to Paula for spending this time with me, and I'm grateful to you listeners for being here again and again and for supporting this show. And if you would like to have more Let's Talk Memoir content, there are a few ways to get it. I am now on Substack under Ronit Plank, and there is a dedicated Let's Talk Memoir publication, which will have memoir tools and encouragement as well as prompts and the latest on the show. Also coming soon is a memoir, Ask Me Anything, which will be a live Zoom that you can register for. Details will be in my Substack, or you can also find them in my newsletter, which I'll put a link for in the show notes as well. And now, here is the last episode for season 3. Today, my guest is Paula Raimon, who is a Venezuelan journalist who has lived and worked in China, the United States, Brazil, and Uruguay. She is currently a correspondent for Agence France-Presse, based in Los Angeles. She has written and reported for the New York Times, National Geographic, Columbia Journalism Review, and Piau Magazine, among other outlets. Welcome, Paula.
Hi, Ronit. How are you? Thank you for having me.
Oh, thank you so much for being here. I'm really happy I got a chance to read your book, Motherland, and I'm so excited to talk with you about all the areas that you cover in your book and to hear how you are these days. So can you share a bit about your new book, Motherland?
Yeah, Motherland is a memoir that I wrote after my mom passed away. It's about that having roots and losing them, and it's about the contemporary history of Venezuela according to my mom's eyes, like about her life, like how the ups and downs of the country, but always from a really personal perspective.
Mm-hmm. And it's funny, you might think I'm a ridiculous person, but I was thinking about your book, you know, when I'm thinking about the questions I'm going to ask and how I want to focus. And I realized I was driving yesterday and I thought, oh, Motherland, because it's so much about her mother and the motherland. I was like, and I thought, well, exactly. Yeah, that's probably why she titled it that way.
It's funny. I didn't choose the name, to be honest, but the person that came with the name was the owner of the publishing house in Brazil the first time that we published the book. And for me, it was like perfect. I even cried the first time that I saw the name because it's perfect. It's
did you, so you titled it something totally different?
I didn't have a title. was way at the beginning of the process, and he came with this idea, and I thought it was fantastic because it really summarized what I was trying to talk about, like how one thing was so connected to the other. So
yes, very much so. It really does really focus and kind of zero in on those themes. And so does that mean that when you sold the book, it was on proposal? Did you, is that how it worked, or did you write the book and then sell it?
I feel a little ashamed, but okay, let's,
it's because wait, I know, wait, like, wait, there's no shame on this show.
No, but it's because my process was completely on the contrary that many writers. So I'm a journalist. I've been working as a journalist for 20 years now. Mm-hmm. And I was not working on a book. I was not expecting to write a book. The proposal came to me, not the other way around. So the publishing, I wrote in a journal kind of article that was published in a magazine in Brazil, and it was like a daily format. So like everyday entries, like today we are doing this, today my mom is buying this or doing that. So it was like in a span of 2 months. Mm-hmm. Of my mom and our conversations, our daily conversations, and like small scenes that she was going through in Venezuela. And this was like a really different article.
Was it a little like a blog?
Yeah, but it was published in a print magazine.
Right, right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it had so much success that this publishing house in Brazil, it's the biggest publishing house in Brazil, they wanted to do a book in this format. They wanted to convert this in a book. And that's how they came to me with the proposal. At the beginning, I was like, I didn't understand clearly because I thought it was like such a big project. And I was super flattered or honored like with this proposal. And we had to change it just like 2 months after they offered me this deal. My mom passed away, so that's why I came with the idea of writing something like telling the story of the country, the 40, 50 years of the country through my mom's life, how she lived through that.
How long do you think, I mean, I always think it's hard to figure out exactly when we started our books and really when we finished our books, but how long did this project take you once you settled on the idea that you were going to follow?
I had to write it like in between pauses, let's say. I had to take like some days off from my work to write. So that stretched the lapse that the time that I had to take for this. But the chapters, the writing was kind of fast. So I would say, like, if you put all the time together, I would say it was no more than 1 year. Like, it was like 6 months, really. But it went through several months just because I couldn't sit and write 8 hours a day for weeks just for this. But then the editing process, it took time as well.
So when you sent in the draft that you felt was pretty good that your editor could look at, so from that point to like publication, how much time went by?
It went, the first edition in Brazil, it went like 1 year, I think. And since for the English edition has been 2 years.
So you've had some time since you last added material.
Yeah.
How do you feel about it now? How do you feel about the process or about the story you've told?
It's writing it, you know, that every time that you read, you can change the story, you can improve it. It's it's a never ending. Sometimes I don't want even to read anymore because it's not the book, but the articles or whatever, because I always going to find things to improve. And I feel pretty happy that I have all this opportunity to reread and to improve. And also with the English edition, we did like, I had this amazing support with the Amazon publishers to edit and transform the material and add things. It was like I feel like it's a really good job. Like a team job, you know?
Yes. Did you find your translator yourself, or did your new publisher, did your English language publisher do that?
They did that. They
Yeah.
also were like they also work on the edits, so it was like I it's a marvelous team effort because everybody like put something on the table. It's like if you write in another language, it's not only about vocabulary, it's about how to convey feelings or emotions or situations to a different cultural audience, you know, so it's really good to have that.
Did that take a lot of time, and were you pretty hands-on with the translation, like the connecting with the translator to make sure that your meaning and impact stayed in place? Did you have a hand in that?
Yeah, it was really interesting. They the translators, there were two translators, and both of them, they reached to me, and we have like a meeting, and they discuss a lot, and I read every version of it, of the draft. So it was really interesting kind of work.
Yes, seems like a lot of work.
Yeah, but I mean, it's good. It's you ensure that it's the best product.
Yes, no, I mean, definitely. And I don't read a lot of books that I'm aware have been translated into English. And I felt very much like that the nuance was there, and that I really got a sense of who you were and what you were really trying to figure out. And, you know, you're a journalist first, and I was wondering what it was like to focus on your experience and share so much about your family history.
Super horrible.
Super horrible.
It was really difficult. It's when first I wrote the first diary, I wasn't used to the attention, to people talking directly to you and saying what they think about the story. And that's a really scary thing to put yourself out there. And it was really difficult to, when you interview somebody, this person choose what to tell you. When you have to write about you, you have to choose what you're going to write. And basically for me, it was really challenging. I wanted to be the honest possible person. I wanted to put the story there that in the most honest possible way. And that was kind of challenging because I was always questioning myself, is this correct? Not because of facts, but because of personal things. Everybody sees things in a different way. So it's difficult because, it's your perspective, the one that is dominating the story. So
It can take a while to calibrate. I think it can take a really long time too. First, for you, I would especially think, because memoir writing is such a particular skill. Mm-hmm. And I think as a journalist, at least maybe traditional journalism, I'm not a journalist, but I would imagine you're not supposed to insert yourself too much into the story. And then here you were really getting personal.
Yeah, we are not supposed to be the story. So when you know that you did it wrong when you become the story.
So, right. Well, so it's like counterintuitive.
Yeah. So it was really difficult, and it was a really personal. So there are pages there that are really personal. At the point that there are things there that I didn't even talk with my friends, with my closest friends, and suddenly it's out there and. It was a painful process. Yeah, it was not easy.
How did you stay focused on it or understand that you wanted to keep doing it even when it was painful?
I think my approach to work is you have to do the things. So I think I didn't think a lot about it. I just knew that I have to finish the book, and I knew more or less what I wanted to, how I wanted to divide it, and I wanted to do it. And basically I have like a periods of time that I needed to cover. And I knew when the book will end, where to start and where to end. So I think I just went through that without thinking a lot, just writing. It's in the most fluid possible way.
You write about a third into the book. I'm just going to quote this about Hugo Chavez. You write that Hugo Chavez was so deeply rooted in our lives that he took on the force of myth. He became a dividing point in our history, Not only did his tenure mark a before and an after, but he also turned the cracks between us into schisms that sometimes seemed harder to resolve than our actual economic crisis. And I was wondering how you think the younger generations coming up now perceive the before and after impact of Chavez on Venezuela.
It's a really interesting question because we have right now Jones, 20 years old generation, that they didn't see anything other than Chavez or Chavismo. And it's really interesting because they don't understand. It's not that the country was perfect before, that's clear, I think, in my book. But they don't understand. I think that the concept of democracy, for example, they don't understand. Obviously, they don't have any faith in politics. They don't, I think like the only thing that young generations now understand is the importance of dollars, migration. There's no future in your country. There's nothing to do here. You have to leave. I think those are ideas that they grew up with. They went through really harsh times, especially middle class that almost disappear, and poor class, like poor people, they understand that what they perceive in their country is you need dollars to survive in here. You don't have any future here, and everybody left, like everybody left, and you need somebody send you money from abroad to pay your bills or to do something. So there's no a normal life. That's, it's been a while since I don't go, but what I noticed is, like, I remember one day I was walking with my nephew in my city. He was 16. This was like 4 or 5 years ago. And I wanted to buy a coffee for him. And there was not, you know, like the coffee shops, like you walk in whatever city and people sitting in coffee shops having a coffee. This is not something that was happening there at the moment because there was no food, etc. It was a fortune to buy a coffee, a fortune for them. And I couldn't, I was like thinking, if I buy a coffee for him, this is the idea that we are reinforcing. Like if somebody comes from abroad, they are rich, they have money, they can pay. And it kills me. It was like, it's, you know, it's something so casual. Like, come on, you just decide and buy a coffee. And this is so simple. Imagine thinking about going to college or like the normal progression of your life. This is something that is lost in Venezuela.
I got that sense so strongly about how much is in ruins. And I found myself, because I didn't know much about, I have to admit, I didn't know a lot about Venezuela before I read your book. And I learned a lot. And I had this feeling that I wanted things to have a good outcome by the end, like a book, right? Like a novel or something really redemptive is going to happen for the country, right? But it's not that.
No, not happening. And it's one thing that I think that people kind of like the book and the article that I wrote before, because people were, everybody's used to read about Venezuela in newspapers or TV or whatever, like, you know, this news about inflation or about elections or discussions or people in jail. But the day-to-day life, like, what is to live in there? I think that's the important part of the book, I think. Like, people get to have their feet in the country and understand how simple moments of life in this country are not simple. Like, you have to think and think and think for everything. And Venezuelans, I don't think there's a happy ending on site for the country. And it pains me to say that, but you can see, like, I just came from the border this week, and it's hundreds of people every day walking for months. So you have to be in a really bad situation to do that, to walk across jungles and whatever to try to find another opportunity. So I don't think, I think the faith in the country is completely lost, which is really sad.
It's more than heartbreaking. It's just, where do you go with that loss, right?
Yeah.
I was wondering if you would read that excerpt we talked about on page 101.
Okay.
And you can set it up if you'd like, if you want to just explain a little bit about where we are in time.
Yeah, this is a moment that I left, I've been like a few years abroad, and I was going through my, since I left the country, I was going through my own personal dramas or dilemmas or situations, professional, emotional, and that's the moment that I was feeling that I couldn't, like, it was impossible for me to talk to my mom about these personal problems, because I thought like the only thing that we could talk about was crisis in my country, so and how to solve problems that she was having, logistical problems. So it was having emotional problems or professional dilemmas, or it felt like nonsense. It felt like it was not a really thing. So okay, it's fine. Even though I wanted to talk about this with Mama, who I call daily, I couldn't. Venezuela and its tragedies were the subject of the day, every day. Knowing I wasn't facing as many hardships as she was, prevented me from sharing my misgivings with her. We talk about my life less and less. I felt guilty for having fun, for spending money on clothes or makeup. It hurt me to be so far away from her. I routinely came up with random excuses to call her, just so we could talk about small things. But when she answered the phone, I couldn't tell her how I felt. Even though discussing trivial stuff with Mama was hard, it was even harder for me to open up about everything I thought was wrong with my life. Mama had never understood my professional choices, so I couldn't expect her to understand why I found it so frustrating to have made it to 30 without the career I'd set out to achieve. The only subject that brought us together was Venezuela. The situation there tormented my mother. After parting ways with Chavismo, she stopped watching state media and started reading websites like Dollar Today, which rose to fame for its reporting on the daily value of the Bolivar against the dollar, and publishing short posts that were critical of the government. Mama was alarmed by everything she read. Sometimes she called me just to tell me about some impending catastrophe, like the discovery of more than 100,000 tons of food rotting in state warehouses as supply shortages escalated. But at that point, fanaticism, ulterior economic motives, and information vacuums were the only way people could still justify the government's actions. Mama learned how to use Twitter, where she regularly boosted posts by opposition leaders, or relayed of lists of problems she encountered in one bureaucratic process or another. Even though she didn't engage much, she also used Facebook as a source of information. Before long, she was watching news shows and interviews on YouTube. Fabiano, which was my husband by the time, Fabiano used to joke that she stopped being a Chavista the moment I gave her a computer and upgraded her internet package. Now she finally had a house of alternative to broadcast television, which was dominated by the government's mandatory networks. While we agreed Chavez was running the country into the ground, my mother craved something more radical than mere elections. She spoke with such verve and animation that I was scared she'd be reckless enough to go to a protest. With her peculiar perspective, she told me she sometimes asked my brother to take her to the occasional opposition demonstration. My brother, now a state police officer, always said no, which offended Mama. Coward, that's what he is, a coward, she told me over the phone. But Mom, he's a cop, I would reply. He's on the other side. If he went with you, he could lose his job. My tongue made clear how obvious this was to me, but it was about more than just logistics to my brother. He was devoted to the revolution. He remained convinced that the country would eventually surge forward and that the opposition was to blame for everything. The levels of violence continued to climb. Even though Chavez had promised to tackle this problem, his government was negligent and permissive. Homicide rates shot up alongside the country's economic prosperity, while control of the prisons was handed over to the criminal factions themselves. By 2010, deputies in Chavez's own party acknowledged that approximately 50 million weapons were circulating in a country with a population of 26 million. According to figures released in 2010 by the Observatorio Venezolano de Violencia, an NGO that took it upon itself to gather these statistics in response to the government's silence, 2009 closed with an homicide rate of 54 per 100,000 residents, which means over 16,000 murders. This figure pales in comparison to the homicide rate of 75 per 100,000 residents, a total of over 19 murders, citing the official National Institute of Statistics report, the report for the same year, which was leaked to the press.
Thank you. So much happens politically and economically, you know, in the book, because it happened in your childhood and young adulthood. And I'm wondering how you went about selecting what to include and what to cut from your manuscript. How did you know?
I didn't know. I think one thing that happens to me while I went abroad is I understood, I started comparing the difference of my childhood and what was to grow up in Venezuela with what happens abroad. So I kind of understood maybe what was different for us. So I think I choose these kind of things. I choose to explain why, because this book was, the first version was for Brazil, right? So it was not a local audience. So I think I choose to explain why, how we grew up, what mm-hmm. things were normal for us. And I knew those things were completely different outside. And what I wanted to give is the perspective of, this is what we went through before Chavez. This is, try to explain how we got here, mm-hmm. how he became the force he became, and what we went through during the first decade of revolution. So revolution is what he used to call his government. So I think that's what was important for me. How can I show what happened in this country that I feel people don't really see mm-hmm. in the news, like in a human way, you know, like putting human faces to the facts.
Yeah, I think it was really grueling to be a witness as a reader to how much you wanted your mom to leave Venezuela. And the book has, you know, the book has so much about not only Chavez, but about the different iterations of your family, like which of your brothers stayed, when did they go, mm-hmm. how your mom's health declined, and the family around you sort of shrank in a sense, because after you lost your father, there had been so much family closeness and parties constantly in your childhood. And as resources shrank and as poverty increased and uncertainty increased, even those kinds of celebrations dwindled. And I feel like you and your family and so many Venezuelans faced these circumstances, and they just worsened over time. The violence, the food shortages, crime, and then the health care, you know, for your mother. And it took such a toll on you, as did the guilt that you felt about it. And I'm wondering how writing this book, and now the passage of some years since you first drafted it, has impacted your understanding of what you've all been through and your guilt about your mom.
It has been like a therapy in the mm-hmm. sense that it made me understand things. It opened things in my mind. Like it, I start like remembering a lot of things about my childhood and my teenager years. And it made me kind of understand. It was difficult not having my mom to talk about it, but it made me understand a lot about her decisions, their decisions, my mom and my dad's decisions. And it made me also understand how things can take a toll on you, how the situation you are going through. And this connects a little with your previous question. Like, we normalize everything. Mm. Everything is normal. So I grew up in a really insecure country, and that was normal for me. Mm-hmm. But that took a toll, and I wasn't aware of it. And I think that's an example. I think writing the book, it made me to look back and understand what things had an impact in my life. Mm-hmm. And like having to be like divided every day into places, I thought that was normal for me. Everything was kind of mm-hmm. normal. And I'm not saying that, oh, poor me, it's not, that's not the sense, but mm-hmm. it takes it all. It takes it all, knowing that you cannot go, like when you accept that you cannot go back to your country because there's nothing else for you there. It takes it all, like it has an impact when you, your personal relations mm-hmm. deteriorate because everything revolves around food and money. Mm-hmm. And when you think you have to find solutions all the time for problems that they are not really problems. And also, like, my mom, she was getting older, she was getting sicker, and she felt alone. And it was a difficult emotional situation, and it was normal that she was, like, in a bad mood most of the time. And mm-hmm. she was frustrated, and mm-hmm. I think I went through all of that looking from afar. Like, when I was going through that, I never had the time to think about it, because you don't have time to think. You have to solve.
Right. Well, I thought about, I have to say, as a reader, I kept thinking, please leave. I wanted her to leave so badly and just get out of there. And I know, of course, that doesn't solve the problem for Venezuela, right? Yeah. But I also thought about your body and your stress level and how much this must have worn you down, not just emotionally, but, you know, physically. Illness could be so common for even the young after dealing with all this kind of stress all the time.
Yeah, and that was the other thing that it was I think it was interesting of all of this effort. It's like when we start writing and reading about migration and about the Venezuelan disaster, we don't think about elder people, and mm-hmm. it's the people that migrate are the young.
Yeah, yeah.
20, 30 years old, maybe 40, but 60, 70, they stay in their country, and it's a moment where they are more debilitated, more vulnerable, and they have to be alone, and they don't have access to medicines, and they don't have proper alimentation, and they don't have any, you know, like recreation, like let's go to the park or the beach this weekend. Mm-mm. And they don't enjoy the grandsons or granddaughters or the sons or the Sunday with the family. And the people always ask, but why this person doesn't leave? And it's not so easy, because it's in which conditions you are going to put this person abroad. Mm-hmm. You have language barriers, you have healthcare barriers, because you have to pay a really good insurance for somebody that is sick in their 70s or their 60s. And this person doesn't have friends, because how is going to connect with friends, doesn't recognize the place. It feels like I have friends that they have their parents abroad, and they decided to go back to Venezuela because they feel like it's like I'm in a nice prison, but it's a prison after all, because I don't have anything besides my kid, you know, like, which is a lot, but it's not enough sometimes. And it's a situation for the elder people. It's a really bad situation, because they are really like trapped.
Mm-hmm. On page 171, in fact, I pulled this little paragraph. You write that your mother felt she'd been abandoned, and this is the quote I pulled. To what extent was this emotional warfare a consequence of what we were living through? I couldn't say. All I knew was that I was exhausted, which I finally worked up the courage to tell her. In the heat of the moment, she admitted to me that she felt like a burden. It became obvious that we didn't have what it took to survive the collapse of Venezuela as a family, which is just, you know, stunningly hard. And I was thinking about this and wondering if you're in touch with your brothers now, and how do you navigate the relationships you have to family still in Venezuela?
Yeah, I don't talk. I try not to talk with my brothers. It's really sad to me to recognize that, but I'm kind of honest in that sense. Because it's like it's not because one thing or another. It's because a lot of things. Mm-hmm. And at some point, I decided that it was better to go in separate ways. Mm-hmm. Because even if you do therapy and you try to treat things, there are painful things that are still there. And mm-hmm. it was, I think it was better for me. I don't know what is going to happen in the future, but that's how I feel right now. And yeah, I talked with some cousins, and recently one of my aunts died. My family in Venezuela is just my mom's family. Mm-hmm. I have a half sister from my dad, but most of the family is my mom's side. And I have the people that read the book can check on that. Like I have like some resentment with some members of the family.
I was going to ask that, if they had read it or knew about it.
No, my mom's, well, there's not a Spanish version, but also mm-hmm. I think it's not, I don't have, my family is not an intellect, they were all in commerce all the time. Mm-hmm. So it's, people are, they're not such interested in reading what I mm-hmm. write, or, but not because any personal, but because, and they, like, I have some cousins that they're really happy, they celebrate about the book, but they didn't read it. Mm-hmm. And there are some family that I really feel is still a little resentment because how things went through. And I know mm-hmm. that you have to understand that the situation was so hard that people, it took the worst of everybody, you know, like yeah. everybody was obsessed with food and money. Mm-hmm. And this is a shame.
Do you feel like you can forgive yourself for the... Not that I think you need to be forgiven. That's not what I mean. But do you find yourself being hard on yourself still for the past and what happened? Or do you feel like you have let that go and understand you've always done the best you could?
I hope one day I can. It's difficult because it's not about people telling me you did the best you could, or it's about how I felt, like, that somebody was the best. Like, cool. She was suffering. My mom was suffering. And I don't know. Like, I think I always going to think that I could mm-hmm. do more. No. And yeah, I think that's, I hope one day reach that feeling that, okay, I did the best I could. But I think in this case, it's really difficult. It's she's not here anymore. So I think, yeah, no, mm-hmm. it's difficult.
Yes, yes. So then in our closing few minutes, I'm wondering, aside from pivoting from a journalist who tried to work more objectively to creating a more personal story, was there anything that stands out about this memoir writing process that was also very challenging that you didn't expect or that you are happy or done with?
It was painful. It was, I cry a lot. Mm-hmm. I cry a lot while writing, and it's, there were moments that thoughts came to my mind. Like I remember things, or I thought about things, or I recheck on things that somehow some things I couldn't believe, other things I were like really sad, especially when I think writing was sad but easier, but mm-hmm. when I had to read, to edit and to check the translations and the editions, and that was the most painful part, because it's maybe it sounds ridiculous, but there were things there that I didn't know I wrote, like I kind of was in trance mm-hmm. writing, and then I had to read it, and it was like, why I wrote that? Because not because it wasn't true, but because it was too personal, and once it's there, and it's not that I don't want it outside, it's that I didn't want it outside of me. Like mm-hmm. when I had to go again through how I felt with things, and things that went through, and that we said to each other, all that part was really painful. And yeah, every reading I cry, and every reading, and it was really difficult.
Mm-hmm. Well, that begs the question. You know, I think memoirists, we know why we do this, but what made you continue? I mean, why is it important to as writers to do this?
I think, like, other, obviously I had to finish, I think, but there were two things that for me were important. And one thing was to put a different story about a country that, like, put some depth to what's the story about my country. I think that was important. I will say three things. That was one thing. The other thing, it was like a really a way to, I used to say that I don't have kids, and I used to say that it was like giving to my mom and my dad a kid. Somebody to remember them, like, you know, somebody to pass a legacy. So their story, their sufferings, their struggles, what they went through. And I think that's what, that was another reason that was really emotional for me. And the other thing, it's the awareness of when we saw migrants, when we see migrants, or when we debate about democracy and the importance of democracy, or when we discuss about these topics, we do it most of the time without, you know, like general topics. So I think one thing that moved me is, you know, like maybe you can see me in the street and this is my story, this is what we went through, and this is why a lot of people migrate from their countries. I cannot talk for everybody, obviously. There are bad and there are good in every story, but you don't leave your country just because. You,
yeah.
More or less. And also, democracy is really important. And we don't just give up on the political process in our countries. We should, I think, like, every generation should be thankful and understanding of why it's important to have choices, why a vote is important, why being able to speak your mind is important. So I think that was something that I wanted to convey there.
And do you have any advice you would like to share with writers who are working on memoirs?
I'm pretty sure people, well, I don't know. I think like the most important thing I will say is, I'm not an expert person, this is just my first book, but be honest. I think what connects us as humans is what all our personal stories, what we went through, what somebody can connect with that personal thing, because we more or less go through same experiences in one way or another, and we all have like a family issues and personal issues and professional issues. So I think like the most honest you are, the most connection you get with your readers, people can connect with that. And I think like that's what every writer wants, readers that can connect with you, with your story, that feel something there.
Thank you. And are there memoirs that you would like to recommend, or that helped you understand how you wanted to write your book?
There's one that I really, but it's in a Spanish book. I don't think it's in English. So it's called La Plaza del Diamante, Diamond Square. It's about the civil war in Spain. It's written by Mercé Rodoreda. Maybe there's an English version.
I'll put it in the show notes, because you never know. And I'm sure some people who are listening speak Spanish.
Yeah, and it's really good because it's about the Civil War, the Spanish Civil War. I read it because of my dad. My dad was in the Spanish Civil War. But it gives you, for me, that's the other thing, like the Spanish history, Civil War history, have this thing about families being divided by war. And it gives you the perspective from the war, but through the eyes of the people.
Yeah.
Not the soldiers necessarily, but how you live it in your house with your family. So that was like really meaningful for me in that process.
Thank you. And lastly, Paola, where can people find you? Where's the best place to connect with you?
Twitter. And I have an Instagram, but whatever, both work pretty well. So Paola Ramon in both, and the handle in Twitter is Paola C. Ramon.
Okay.
And Instagram is Paola C. E. Ramon.
Okay. All right. I'll add that in there too. Thank you. Thank you so much for making time to be on this show, and for sharing so much of your truth with me, and being willing to talk about this really hard material. I really appreciate it.
No, thanks to you, Ranit. It was like a wonderful opportunity for me. So thank you for having me, and really, really thankful.
Thank you for tuning in to Let's Talk Memoir. For more about this episode and my guest, please visit the link in the show notes or on Instagram at Ronit Plank. That's RONITPLANK. You can also follow me on Twitter, Facebook, and TikTok. If you liked this episode of Let's Talk Memoir, please go ahead and share it with your friends and subscribe. And if you have 2 more seconds, you can rate and review it on Apple Podcasts, which really does help other people find the show. Thank you so much for being here.